Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Grayscale Gorilla Podcast. I'm freezing over here. I got all my gear on. I'm outside yelling into the mountains, and with me today is Chris Schmidt. How are you, buddy?
I got a horrible cold today, but besides that, I'm doing well.
We're all killing it. What kind of ailments you got, Chad?
Just dealing with the post-time change ailment.
Good. Well, thanks for joining me. I'm ending the road trip here pretty soon. I'm currently in Kings Canyon, which is in California, at this little lodge where I stayed, and it's a little cold out. That's okay. I got my mittens, got my scarf. Wi-Fi is warming me up, and I figured I'd call you guys, see what's going on. We have a few announcements today, and we have a pretty fun topic I think will help a lot of people no matter where you are in your motion design career. If you're new to the podcast, this is episode 97. We are almost to 100. We're going to do something special for 100, so stay tuned for that. 97 podcast episodes. Thanks, guys, for joining this. And, of course, as we got into the 90s, I've been talking about some of my favorite albums because I love music. That was like such a big part of my life. And of course, like all the music you're into in high school is like everyone's favorite music, right? No matter when you went to high school, that's the best year in music. And that's the same for me. And I just want to read off some of the hits here. 97, number one. Now this is a list here on besteveralbums.com. And it says number one album from that year, OK Computer, Radiohead. What a hit. What a hit. We got Bjork, Elliot Smith, Modest Mouse, Spiritualized, The Verve, Foo Fighters, Godspeed You Black Emperor, which I never got into, but I appreciate. I think it's all instrumental. Pretty good stuff to work to. I've heard Built to Spill, one of my favorite bands. And of course, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. And then of course, if you go to the singles, you get all the awful Elton John remakes and all that stuff. You don't want to go to the singles, folks. You want to stick to the albums.
What Foo Fighters album was it that dropped?
Color and Shape.
I think that's the second one.
Second one.
That's my favorite album.
And The Verve, dude. That track, actually, that entire album is so good. Like the sound on that Verve Urban Hymns album. I mean, everyone knows Bittersweet Symphony, but if you like that song and you're like, oh, I always like that song when it comes on, that album is bonkers. Anyway, I have to do it. As we get into the, as soon as we hit 2000 or 100, which will bring us to like 2000, I'm out. I'm just stuck to my high school stuff. But
that's also the time that all those director series music videos were dropping.
Yes.
I think I owned that box set with Spike Jonze and Chris Cunningham and Michelle Gondry and like that whole series, man, like all those music videos. That's kind of what inspired me to get more into motion design.
We're going to talk about a little bit about that today too. And I would say that series and MK12 were the two things that got me into what I do, like by far, like Spike Jonze, Michelle Gondry in particular. And then Chris Cunningham, like I warmed up to him. And who's the other guy that did 1 Hour Photo and he did the Lenny Kravitz video that I'm obsessed with. Who's that guy? Anyway, that series is bonkers. When I used to have house parties in Chicago, I would put that on the TV on loop. That would be like the visual entertainment for the night. It was just those director series on my 27-inch TV. God, I'm old. All right, let's see if there's any other follow-up, and we'll get into today's topic, which I'm pumped about. Did I mention it's freezing out here? If my teeth start chattering, will you guys mute me? Because this is going to be an interesting one. Okay, so real quick, couple announcements before we get into this. The Sunday before NAB, if you are going to Vegas for NAB, I want to see you guys. We're going to be around the booth. We're going to be around the show floor. We're going to be presenting at the Maxon booth. Let me just tell you about this party, though. If you're going to be there by Sunday before, it's April 8th. If you're going to be in Vegas on April 8th for NAB, you are invited. you're invited to the MoGraph meetup at Beer House, and it's over by New York, New York. It's kind of across the street from MGM. I know where a lot of people stay, but this is going to be a party. It's bonkers. We got it's sponsored by School of Motion, Grayscale Gorilla, The Future, Video Copilot, and MoGraph Mentor, and AE Scripts. So, like, who we got everybody.
You
gotta come. Boom.
Boom, right? Goes the dynamite.
And so please be there. We would love, honestly, our favorite part of NAB is like bumping into our customers and people that have watched our stuff and hearing your story. And like, this will be the best place to do that. Like, everyone will be here hanging out. There'll be drink tickets. There's all this awesome stuff. So we're going to put a link to that. And this is, this sounds like it will sell out. So be sure, if you hear my voice, go to this link, click down below. If you're watching on YouTube, or if you're watching, listening on the podcast, just find the link. We got a little snowblower action over here, folks. If you hear that in the background. But anyway, let me finish this off by saying we're really excited to have everybody. AE Scripts, AE Plugins, MoGraph Mentor, Video Copilot, Grayscale Gorilla, The Future, School of Motion. I'm excited to see not only all of those people, but all of you who are going to be there. So definitely check this out. Register, get a ticket. Hope to see you in Las Vegas. A couple of other quick announcements. We're also going to be at NAB that entire week. Come find us. We're going to be walking around the show floor. Chris and I have a presentation at the Maxon booth. So you could go to c4dlive.com to learn more about when we're going to present. And then, Chad, you were also on another podcast. And that's coming out this week. Can you tell our audience about that? I think they'd enjoy that.
Yeah. So I was invited to talk about one of my favorite cartoons of all time on a cartoon podcast called Toon Talk Weekly. So that'll be dropping tomorrow, which is going to be Tuesday. It'll be out probably by the time you hear this, where I'm going to be talking about one of my favorite cartoons of all time, which is classic Looney Tunes, golden era, 1940s, 1950s era of Looney Tunes. And we just talk all about the influence that that's had on pop culture, on me, and just all the cool stuff that that studio put out around that time. And it's a great podcast, and those guys do it upright. You should definitely subscribe and check them out.
They do some fun podcasts. I was actually on that same podcast like 2 years ago, talking about one of the shows that got me into 3D, which was Reboot. And yeah, you know, I knew a whole bunch of the history of it and background. So it's really fun that they get to talk about a whole bunch of different cartoons. So that's fun. Yeah, it's a lot more weird cartoons than I realized that there were. As many as I watched, there's even more.
Yeah, when I was talking to Jake, one of the hosts at a meetup, and I was like, yeah, you know, I really want to be a guest. You know, I love the show. And he's like, well, what cartoon would you want to talk about? I'm like, I'm sure you've already covered it, but Looney Tunes. He's like, actually, we've never talked about Looney Tunes. And I'm like, what? He's like, we do a lot of like more modern and 80s cartoons. I'm like, well, you got to do Looney Tunes because they wouldn't exist without Looney Tunes. He's like, well, I've never had a guest that he's like, I never felt like I knew it well enough to do it on our own. And we haven't had a guest want to come on and talk about it yet. You're the first person who knows anything about it. And I'm like, I'm so there, dude. Let's do this. Let's schedule this. So we scheduled it and we talked about it. And ironically, that's the cartoon that got me into animation. So they did mention your podcast, Chris, about how you talked about what got you into 3D, and I'm talking about what got me into animation. So it's kind of a cool podcast. Check them both out.
Cool. We'll put those in the show notes as well.
Totally.
Let's make sure to talk. Bam. Dude, that's awesome. I got to think about, because to me, I was just at the Disney Museum, which was in San Francisco. And I totally forgot about some of my early, early favorite cartoons. They were the Goofy, like sports cartoons. So there was like Goofy Learns how to Swim and Goofy Learns How to Ski. And I think there was another one, like a tennis one or something like that. And they're all just where he gets hurt the whole time. Like he does the classic like wahoo-wee kind of goofy fall.
No, that's not the Wilhelm scream, is it? No,
it's got a similar like vibe to it. It's more like he's yodeling as he's
yeah, falling. It's like yeah, like, I love
the goofy yell's the best.
Yeah, that is pretty good.
I totally forgot about those. And then I was also reminded of the Donald Duck science slash history ones. And those had a really unique art style. They were like from the 60s, and they were like, it would start off with like Donald Duck playing pool, and he's like really bad at it. And then I think like Professor Duck comes in and tries to like teach him angles and geometry. And there's one about the history of music.
I remember that guy.
I used to love those, man. All right. Well, let's get into today's topic. I think I have a time limit before I just shiver to death out here. I thought I'll be polite, sit outside, get some nice lighting. Did not remember how cold it was out here. So I think this will be an interesting
we have a built-in time limit. So
yeah, I'm just gonna talk really fast about my favorite stuff. So today I thought here's the concept behind today's topic. And it'll sound similar, I think, to some other topics that we've covered. But, you know, not everybody listens to all 100 podcasts, right? So I'm hoping that that today's topic will kind of get you thinking about what that next thing is. So let me just frame it in this way. More and more, as I talk to students, as I listen to stories about people in our industry that are successful, as I listen to podcasts, I come across this concept that it's basically never the obvious stuff that you learn that sets you up for success in whatever career you're doing. And this applies to almost all creative careers. Today we'll be talking about motion design and Cinema 4D and all that, of course, but it's almost never the obvious stuff that sets you up. So let me try to explain this a little bit further. If all you learn is everything about Cinema 4D, it's hard to abstract that into a full career. In other words, and we talk about this all the time, learning how to talk to clients, learning design, learning typography, learning all this stuff adds up to a more well-rounded career, or adds up to a more well-rounded person that is easier to hire, easier to find, and it, like I said, just through my story and other stories I hear, leads to a more successful career. So I thought we could do today, since it's kind of a quicker podcast anyway, is kind of go around in the circle and talk about some of the non-obvious stuff that we learned in our career that set us up for success that maybe we didn't even know at the time was going to help us. And my goal in this is to have you, the listener, listen to some of these stories and try to think of maybe one of these things that grabs your attention, that you can go in that direction and start learning it. Because look, like I'll get off my soapbox in a second here, but you know, what our goal is here with this podcast is to set you up for a successful career as a creative person, no matter where that is. And if it's only a focus on the tools, then if we only focus on the tools, then we're doing you a disservice. I'll say it as clearly as that. I consider it our job to try to be as good educators as we can. And in the process of educating, we have to be as well-rounded and teach as well-rounded as we can as well. So hopefully that sets it up, you know, and we'll kind of just go around the circle and talk about some of the secondary things that we all learned or were interested in when we were younger that set us up to be better at motion design and 3D. I don't know if either of you want to start with that, or, you know, hopefully I set it up okay to talk through, but Chad or Chris, do you have any?
I have a very specific baseline one that I might mention in general. And it's one I didn't have an appreciation for a long time about how maybe not how important it is, but if you grew up at all playing video games, you've got such a foundation of the way 3D works. And to me, it was so obvious because I had played a whole bunch of video games. I didn't think about it. But when I was teaching the Introduction to Cinema 4D course, you could very clearly see, well, I said, and there's definitely some bias here, but like a whole bunch of the guys had like all this video game experience. But then there'd be older people in the class who like the young guys would be like, oh, video games, they get it. They know how to rotate the camera and they understand like, okay, here's the object. Here's the camera. They have this relationship. Things move around, like the placement of things and the fact that there's depth. There's a very, there's an intuitiveness to it that I obviously had as well, to the point where I didn't even think about it. But then maybe some of the older people in the class, they didn't have that vibe for the way the camera rotates around, that they had like real problems with the idea of depth to the camera and just an intuitiveness there that it's really interesting to think about how even something as vague as that background, like just running around, even playing Doom, would probably give you a basis of like, oh, I understand depth and angles and trajectories and how the camera moves around in relationship to that. So just as kind of a basic springboard where a lot of people listening probably can relate a little bit on that level. But along those lines, that's a skill that you might not even think about, that you have that and you got that for free. And there's a lot of people who don't have that. And that was more of a struggle to break that barrier.
All right. This is great. Everybody, play more video games. Step one. that is it's funny you say that. I'm an 80s kid, right? Like I grew up with a Nintendo and Atari and then Nintendo 64 kind of brought the 3D stuff to life. And you're right. There's like an intuitiveness to understanding 3D space that video games is such an obvious start for that. So yeah, that's perfect. Let's get a list together for our audience out there. Play more video games. I'm gonna write that one down. I like that. Chad, would anything come to mind?
Oh man. So things that have sort of, I think, made me better at my job than I probably would have if I hadn't sort of fallen in love with this sort of thing. And that would be, along the way, I picked up design and that was like a huge, I never thought of myself as a designer when I was in college or even right after graduating and getting my first job in 3D. I just never thought of myself as a designer. I picked that up along the way as a way to sort of be able to make my work look better. And I had no formal training. I didn't really understand typography that much. I didn't really know the lingo, and I didn't really understand composition as it relates to 2D design. And I just learned that some people made stuff that looked better than other people, and I could tell it looked better, and I didn't really have the language as to why it looked better. So what I did was I just started to absorb as much as I possibly could of people that I thought did design very well, either people that were in the same office as me or in books or online places, or people that I really thought had some really great looking stuff. And for me, it came from like a history of skateboarding and the skateboarding culture and skateboarding magazines and skateboarding graphics, and all that stuff was already sort of in my subconscious and there. And I knew what looked good and I knew what worked together and how to do composition and type design and things of that nature. I just never really put the two together until I was in a place where I saw animators working with designers and maybe sometimes even doing the same tasks. And that sort of like two great tastes that taste great together, that peanut butter and chocolate moment for me when I figured out like design can work with 3D and they can sort of become one. That was a huge eye opener for me, and learning how to really set type in a beautiful way. And even I think in halfway into my career, I was doing quite a bit of stuff that wasn't even 3D. I was doing type, like actual titles, and it wasn't 3D at all. And that really forced me to look at my work in a different way and not have it always be about 3D and have it be more about, okay, well, what's the message I'm trying to convey? What does this typeface say about the emotion of this piece? How should it move? Should it move tastefully? Should it move crazy ways? Like what's the best way to tackle this? So I guess when I kind of learned that 3D and design could work well together was a huge moment for me. One of many.
Yeah, that's definitely a big one. I've told that story many times, but I think MK12, you know, to me is the perfect combination of all of those things. They had motion design, they had 3D, they had typography, they had like poster design, like all the things that I was kind of a little bit into. They were, you know, like they had a video game kind of like you know, James Bond kind of vibe to them. Everything about that pulled me in, and I was like, oh yeah, okay, design. Oh yeah, typography for sure. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely on my list. Let me write that one down. A big one for me, we've talked about before too, but again, still such a huge part of learning about making pretty looking rectangles. And to me, I never really thought about that was ultimately going to be my job, is making pretty looking moving rectangles. And to me, it was photography that really helped clarify what that meant. Because I think before photography and before Cinema 4D, when I was just learning After Effects and figuring out all I could do with After Effects, I had a somewhat intuitive sense about 3D. After Effects had 3D stuff built in, but the design and the composition and where things fit in a rectangle was just not a part of my brain. And so what a camera did for me was force me to take things that were already made. So hopefully I'm not backtracking too far, but in Photoshop, in 3D, in After Effects, you not only had to make the thing, but then when you were done with it, you then also had to frame it in a beautiful way. So if you think of 3D, you have to find the models, texture them, light them, and get your scene all set up, and then whip your camera out to then figure out where it's going to be placed in the scene. And just by removing all of that and just saying, okay, I have a camera now and I have the real world outside of me, how do I now just not worry about the making of it, not worrying about the texture of it, not worrying about any of the technical stuff, and just take this, you know, house or this tree or whatever and make a beautiful rectangle? That helped me rule of thirds and hierarchy and, you know, lenses. We talked about this in a couple other podcasts, obviously, but camera, really studying how photography worked and how to draw a certain emotion with a photo, 100% helped me make more beautiful rectangles for a living. I think I'm gonna change my business card. Just like I try to make beautiful rectangles.
Yeah, but that even goes in if you want to focus in more, because those are just polygons.
That's right.
Sometimes even triangles. A modeling.
That's funny.
To piggyback off the last one, I was saying a little bit, but in a different way, something that I have found very useful was not video games themselves, but the video game map editors. As a kid, I got obsessed. Well, even this is like late middle school, early high school. There was StarCraft, and StarCraft had this amazing map editor where you, especially once Brood War came out, you could do essentially anything that the game designers could do, you could now do behind the scenes. And I would just make level after level after level, and I had a buddy, and we would test it, and then I had my brothers, and they'd play all these maps I'd make, so I had like a small audience. And then in college, I started making maps, and we'd all play those games together. But and it's not just StarCraft. There's a lot of different games that have map editors. And a lot of those map editors will have things like triggers. And you start learning about like if-then conditionals. Like if this happens, make this happen. And it isn't so much just that they have that. It's as you do it and you do it again and again and again, you start understanding on an intuitive level, like setting up conditions to go and do this. And honestly, in a lot of ways, that is the foundation of programming. Like if I have any intuition for programming, it's because I played with video game map editors. And that's to get into like Espresso and coding. But even beyond that, you know, like Unreal always had map editors. You can make your own Unreal. Now they got the whole engine you can get. And you have things like Unity where you can go and get the Unity engine for free and just start playing around and learning simple conditions and designing maps and playing around with the way those things lay out. Like I was building maps in the Unreal Engine before I was ever using Cinema 4D. So there's a lot you could do. I mean, that's some of this is going into the past, but the idea of you know, whatever, you've got like a kid or something, like playing, making, like modding a game in Star or like Minecraft these days or something, like modding a game, learning how you can install different components, like building algorithms and just setting things up. Like man, that sets you up so well for giving a foundational intuitive knowledge of the way coding works.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Minecraft. I think that there's something there with Minecraft that I think is doing a lot of what we've already said. It's like 3D video game, you know, open world, map editor. It's kind of all that rolled into one, right? And everybody, like, we have this entire generation of kids playing with that. And yeah, I wonder what that's going to do, because I know for me, having computers early on in my life was a big help, and just being comfortable around computers, but also playing games like, you know, Theme Park and like Roller Coaster Tycoon and stuff like that. Like, I had a similar experience where I'm like, okay, I'm comfortable moving in 3D, and I'm comfortable with like building things and setting stuff up and, you know, setting up domino effects basically inside of a video game. No wonder I fell right into MoGraph stuff, right? So yeah, it's hard, you know, it's hard with those things, because it's hard to look forward and say, oh yeah, it's all my video game experience that made me successful. And if that was the only case, then we'd have a lot more people in this industry. But I think that that's an interesting way to look at it. Like, map editors is that's an interesting one. Going on the list, Chad, anything pop out for you?
Man, like, hearing you guys talk about the video game thing, I didn't really, I mean, I was had the Atari and all that sort of thing, but I never really got into them, to be honest. And I think when just hearing you guys talk about that, it made me think, like, wow, if I really like extrapolate like something really fundamental to how I came up, and I guess this is going to sound weird, but bear with me, being nearsighted. So I can see close, but I can't see far. So if I think about how I interpreted the world when I was impressionable and young, I didn't even know I needed glasses until I was in probably fourth or fifth grade. Oh, so
I got mine as well.
my entire life, like, everything was close to me. So like, playing with Star Wars figures was like my favorite thing to do, and drawing, because drawing was something that I could do and I could see, and I just did it all the time. I drew constantly. And so my entire ability to observe things at that scale translated in later into 3D for my ability to create realistic textures, because I observed the world very close up. I looked at everything I was doing when I was making worlds with my Star Wars figures, all the making forts out of sticks, and just all the textures and everything that I was able to look at, and then drawing and looking at forcing myself to look at the world through a small canvas, translated all into what I did later on. And I guess I never really thought about it until now, and in terms of how I looked at the world influences how I create things now. It's kind of an interesting way to think about it.
Yeah, that's that is an interesting one. Like, trying to figure out, it's kind of like the photography thing. It's like how to make this piece of paper come to life, and thinking of it in that way. Like,
that's all I did was, I mean, you guys probably drew a lot too. I think a lot of people in this business grew up just doodling and drawing all the time. And that's what I did my entire adolescence, was art. Like, I did fine art all through college and loved it. I was spent all my time in high school in the art room. Almost every free moment I had, I was in there working on a project. And then I did all the, you know, the shows and the contests and everything at that level. And I thought, like, that's what I want to do. And then I thought, I love filmmaking and I love cartoons. Looney Tunes brought that up earlier. And I was like, there's gotta be a way I can like marry these two together. So that's when I started studying film and traditional animation. But it all started because I couldn't see far away. That's at least crazy. maybe that's what it is. I'm just guessing, but many things, but that definitely helped.
All right. So hold on. We got to update, play a lot of video games, get some inverse glasses, you know?
It's funny, man. When you think about like, Chris, you wear contacts, right?
Yeah.
So I think about this sometimes. Do you guys ever think about like how completely screwed you'd be if you were alive in like the 16 or 1700s. Like,
oh, 100%.
Just be, I would be completely dead.
Like my dad would have been so blind, he wouldn't have been made it old enough to have kids. So,
right.
I constantly appreciate modern day and modern technology. So, that's
about it. And like, I look at it, like, sometimes I'll forget my glasses or I'll just take them off or whatever. Or, you know, like, the best is like when you're on vacation. And everybody's got this, you know, the scuba masks on. And of course, you know, I don't wear contacts. So I'm in the water with my scuba mask. I can't see a damn thing. And like, there could be a shark coming up on me. I would have no idea. And I'm like, I would so be dead if these were like pioneer days, you know, like I would just not be alive. So I'm thankful.
Well, I would have to get, I would have to get a real job at that point too. And I'd be no help.
Yeah, along those lines, I start thinking if all of society just collapses and everything goes down, like I need to get more practical skills. It's just thinking, you know, if we suddenly lose like computers and internet, like I'm screwed. I need something a little more practical.
Yeah, we maybe that should be the podcast. It's like, what skill can you develop for the zombie apocalypse?
Well, so yeah, maybe I have one. Maybe this isn't quite the zombie apocalypse skill, but maybe it's the one after things settle down, you could have something to do. But to me, a lot of people I worked with, and again, this is kind of how I'm basing a lot of this, is like not just my experience, but like the people that I saw that worked in the industry, that were happy, that were good at what they did, at least a lot of the ones that I worked with, and they enjoyed advertising and they enjoyed marketing. Now I'm talking about working in marketing and advertising, right? But they enjoyed the process of it. When a really good commercial was on the Super Bowl, we would all dissect it the next day for hours. When a really awesome new infomercial popped up, we would all like secretly go talk about how crazy it was. A beautiful ad in a magazine that was just the right headline, or the new Volkswagen commercial, or, you know, like whatever that was, there was always this interest in like, wow, they really knew their market and they nailed it. And for me, that was something that I didn't know I was interested in until I started learning about it. Learning about, you know, Ogilvy and early advertising in general, and Sears and Roebuck, and how they built their catalog and started to sell things. Basically, they sold things through mail order. The whole history of how commerce was built through not just visual arts, but through marketing and through psychology and all that stuff was something that I'm glad I got interested in. And I'm glad that I still enjoy today. And to me, there's, you know, if you're working commercially in this industry, a lot of that work is commercial work. A lot of that work is selling a product. A lot of that work is getting the word out about an organization or about an upcoming event. And all of that stuff is marketing and advertising. And so if that rings a bell with you, if that's something you've always been interested in, we talked about cartoons a little earlier. I have warmer feelings about the 80s commercials than I do about the 80s cartoons. I was not like a He-Man fan or a G.I. Joe fan.
Wait, man, just so we're clear, that was a commercial? Just so you're clear.
Oh, yeah. No, no, no. Let's go down that path for a second. You are 100% correct. The commercial was the idea that they made a G.I. Joe commercial. Or I'm sorry, let's start over. You're going to edit that out, right? Thanks, Jack. The idea that they made a cartoon to sell action figures makes my heart light up like no other. Like, they have that new series on Netflix. I think we've talked about a little bit already, but it's what's it called? The Toys That Made Us?
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah, it's so good. Go watch it if you haven't seen it.
And what I'm realizing is like, there wasn't a GoBots cartoon, and then they decided to make the action figures because the cartoon was popular. It was 100% backwards. They invented G.I. Joe as an action figure, And then once it was, once they really wanted to sell a bunch of them, they're like, I know, I'm going to make a cartoon. All of this is to say that I love stories like that. I love how things are made and sold in the commercials and the tagline of He-Man and all that stuff. If that stuff interests you, take a peek at, like, you know, traditional, where advertising, where marketing, where getting the word out about things you can buy to make yourself happy comes from. And there's a lot of consumerism BS that goes along with all this stuff. And there's a lot of weird scammy stuff in like marketing circles. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about how to get the word out about anything. And that goes not just for the potential commercial you might make in your career, but it also, for me, it taught a lesson on how to get the word out about myself as well as an artist. We talked about early days at Creamy Orange not too long ago and building a brand around that instead of just my name and maybe, you know, picking certain colors and certain themes and music and how all that plays into creating a brand and creating yourself and getting the word out about this stuff. And so I won't get back into that because we've talked about this on many podcasts, but being interested in marketing and advertising, I see as a correlation to people that obviously work in this industry, but also that seem like they're good at it. I'm going to put a book in here too that really opened me up about this. Probably one of my favorite books. It's probably one of my favorite books ever, and it only takes like 5 minutes to read. And so I'll put it in the show notes down below here. I'll call it.
That's interesting that you talk about that that side of things. And I definitely think that, like, I was aware of commercials that were funny or interesting and whatnot, but I wasn't super interested in the actual, like, cogs and the makings of those things. I liked what some of them did, and I obviously was a sucker for a lot of those commercials growing up because I would want to go buy that stuff like right away. But for me, I think what really got me going was just like movie magic and like the magic of the feeling that you get when you came out of watching Ghostbusters or E.T. or something, and like that whole thing where you're like, this whole world exists that I have no idea how they're doing, making that Marshmallow Man look like he's, you know, five stories tall. And like, how did they, I mean, just like, it just, the magic of it was just so unbelievable to me. And that is what I think carried me through the beginning, like wanting to get into sort of a creative career, was like, how do I want to be a part of that sort of, maybe not that exact VFX magic, but that feeling of like, this is magic. Like, I don't know how to describe it. And that's the only word that I can use to describe it. Cause it's more of like this feeling that you get when something hits you on an emotional level to and takes you to a place that is just like mind-blowingly awesome. And that sounds like that sort of advertising sort of stuff really kind of made your brain work that way. And for me, it was more like these creating worlds, and like the idea of escaping to these worlds and in these movies was always like fascinated me and just made me so excited.
I think we've all kind of mentioned like world building in a way. You know, Chris is talking about building maps and Minecraft and StarCraft maps and. Yeah. You know, and I had this like theme park game and there's this idea that, and I've said this before, but it's like the behind the scenes of things can be more interesting than the front of the scenes of things. And for me, I know anytime I'm watching a show and there's a really cool light effect, I'm wowed by the light effect. And then I'm also looking for like, what did that? Like, I'm looking around the theater, right? Like, I'm trying to find the person with the spotlight or whatever. I think that has a lot of what we do and how, you know, and the interest of how things are made and how things work. And I think to me, that's what marketing did for me. And that's what advertising was like, oh, this is why, like understanding that the only reason TV exists is to sell commercial time. Like that blew my mind. I'm like, wait a minute. Wait. So you have to sell all the commercials before you could even barely get a TV show on? They're like, yeah. It's like the whole point of television. The show brings the right person to the screen so that they could sell them stuff in between the show. Like, oh my God, that is so weird. And I want to learn more about this weird little world. So yeah, it's like, I'm hearing some similarities like behind the scenes, world building. Let's do one more quick round here. You know, maybe just something that, I know Chris, you had one that you mentioned before. I'd love to hear about. Maybe we'll start there.
Yeah, I got a good segue too. Like going both to the world building and the commercials when we were kids. So the late 80s, early 90s commercials. If you guys remember Zach the Lego Maniac and all those amazing commercials, where it's like they like time lapse the Lego set getting built and they'd be flying around and crashing into things. Like,
oh my god, I completely forgot about that guy.
Yeah, Zach the Lego Maniac. I know I've mentioned it before and it's totally a thing for me, but like Legos, growing up with Legos wired my brain for like 3D and problem solving. Like, and it's even like, I find like my entire life is kind of structured on the way I played with Legos growing up, which was like having a catalog of all the pieces and understanding all the potential a single piece has and all the ways it can be turned around and combined and put in an interesting different direction. And just know, like, essentially like every piece being a tool, like maybe that's a, like it's a cube or it's a way of extruding something, or it's a way of, you know, like a module in MoGraph, or, you know, all these different things. And combining them and dismantling, and just the idea of making something and rotating it around, and symmetry, and like, and even my overall process of, I tend not to visualize something before I make it. I tend to do a lot of like add and subtract until I end up with something I really like, which is like, oh, let's try combining these pieces. Oh, I don't like the head. Take that off. Start it again. Like, do this. Oh, I decided a different color. Dismantle that. Put this different color on, and just iterate. And it's just the way I play with Legos. It's the way I would start drawing things, where I'm very like very precise and like draw things out. I didn't like that. Erase out. Do it again until I get exactly what, you know, iterate until I get it. And like, almost every aspect of my life is, yeah, I can see that same process. And I know it's one of those things where it's like, okay, chicken and the egg. Was Lego super appealing to me because my brain liked that meticulous, like, iterative process? Or do I like iterative processes because I was doing and grew up with so many Lego around the house? So, but man, like, just wiring, the fundamental wiring of my brain is because of Lego.
I've
mentioned this before, but my it was a big thing because, you know, I have three younger brothers, and, you know, all of us would do Lego stuff together. And there's a rule in the game: if you're building things, that the more rare the piece was, if it was built into whatever you're building, it makes it a more valuable thing in universe. So if, you know, we only have one of this piece. So if that gets built into your robot, then that's a better robot now. And the color that was in general the most rare for us to use back in that day was dark gray. And dark gray pieces were just like, okay, everything looked good in dark gray, and you could make robots, but you could also make castles. And it was just a somewhat rare color. And to this day, I just have this intuitive love of dark gray. Like, my car is dark gray. I was just trying to do countertops and I sent you guys images, and there's like all these like dark gray, and you guys are like, you really should be using a lighter color there. It's like, but I just like dark gray so much. And like, I have to think that goes back to like how valuable dark gray pieces were.
While you've been going on this, I've been watching Zach the Lego Maniac commercials on YouTube, and I gotta say, there's a little bit of a resemblance between you and Zach the Lego Maniac. There's actually there's one of the images we have of Chris is like this mad scientist image of Chris, where I think you have some goggles on your head or something.
Yeah.
And the beginning of this Zach the Lego Maniac commercial, he has these like 80s sunglasses that almost look like goggles, and he pulls them up over his head, and I swear to God, it is Chris. I'm gonna link this. This is gonna blow your minds.
That's amazing.
It's okay, Chris. We know you were Zach.
I remember when I was a kid. I don't know if this is actually tied in, but I remember when I was a little kid, I was like, "Man, if I have a son, I'm going to name him Zach. Zach's the coolest name," and that might be because of that commercial.
Dude, this is amazing.
Look at this guy. I love it. Yeah, he's got the big glasses on. All right, we got a link. We got to put that in the show notes, there, buddy. That's awesome.
I love Chad.
I do too. Do you have a last one to close us out almost?
Oh man. Nothing that's like coming to my mind specifically. I guess if we get a bit more further down the timeline of my career, where I was like, okay, was going to do traditional animation, couldn't do it, couldn't draw well enough, got into 3D animation. Okay, this is something I can do. I like it. And then I learned like the concept of manipulating images after they were rendered, and that was called compositing. And like, why is that valuable? Oh my gosh, it's completely valuable, because now I can, it doesn't stop right there when I do the render. I can actually fix things. And I remember vividly getting a job pretty early in my career, and very nervous about being the only 3D artist at the studio. And I was sort of just nervous about it. And I remember spitting out a render for this commercial. It might've been an end tag for McDonald's or something. I don't remember what it was. And I brought it into my boss's office. He was a compositor, and I had no idea what that meant. It was all like smoke and mirrors to me. And I walked in, I'm like, okay, I got that render for you. Here it is. And he loads it up and he's like, oh, it looks like you have, At that point, I think I was using Maya. He's like, oh, looks like you have a bad frame here, or like a missing, like some error, some noise or something. And I was so devastated. I was like, oh my God, I blew it. I completely blew it. He's going to be so mad, because it took all night to render this thing, and I'm screwed. And I'm like, I'm so sorry. I can fix that and just re-render it. Right when he's like, oh, I've already fixed it. He looked over to me. And while I was like talking about what I was going to do, he painted it out. He just like painted out the problem. Oh, I fix it. You're good. I'm like, wait, what did you just do? He's like, I painted it out. I painted out this like part of the frame right here. Well, how did you do that? Oh, I just cloned it from this area over here. I was just like, this is voodoo that I must learn like tomorrow, because it was just such a different way of thinking about things, about it not being perfect and it being something that is malleable up until the very last moment. And that just was like, holy, that was like mind blowing. And so I'd said, okay, I'm learning compositing. And I didn't want to learn flame, because that was just too far down that rabbit hole for me. And I quite frankly just didn't think I was smart enough to learn it. It seemed like a very complicated tool. So I picked up After Effects and I picked up Combustion. And from there, I was like, okay, this is something I can wrap my head around. And that's when I realized how powerful compositing was and really got into it for a long time. It became really a big part of my process.
Yeah, you taught me a lot of stuff early on, like, you know, even passes and understanding why there was reflection passes and AO passes and basic 3D comp. I didn't know why any of that stuff existed. You know, like my goal, I kind of tricked myself into learning composition or compositing only because I was so bad at Cinema 4D that I wanted to do anything I could to bring it back into After Effects. That's where I was comfortable, and I knew that I could fix whatever I barely got out in, like if I just barely got a 3D rotating globe, crappy lit 3D rotating globe out of 3D, that I could make it look good in After Effects because I had those skills. And so to me, it was like, I kind of came at it a backwards way, but yeah, that is a huge skill to learn that isn't obvious, that does pay dividends, not just on time, but on creativity, allowing you to do more with less time, but also combining 2D and 3D skills together to create something that is kind of, you know, impossible. Just like, you know, like trying to do a fade out. Like, here's what I want. At the end of this animation, I want it to like fade out to black. And they're like, okay, how many layers in Cinema 4D do I have to add to do that? Like, whoa, wait. Hold on.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I would always really and try to instill in the artists working for me over the years is to not be so precious with what you're doing and just take your 3D up to a point in which it looks good enough to bring it into the comp and finish it. It doesn't have to be pixel perfect in the 3D app. You can just take it to the point where, okay, there we go. That's good. Now I can finish the rest in comp. And if you can really get that comfortable compositing, fixing things, color grading, and I'm not talking about necessarily, like, I went through a period where I was like, I'm going to spit every pass out and recombine every pass to have ultimate control over my 3D renders in the comp. That sort of went away pretty quickly after a few jobs where it just became such a pain in the ass.
Yeah, went too far the other direction.
Yeah, it just like, it's like, why am I, what? No, build an amazing beauty render and generate mats. Like, I knew once I learned compositing, I learned that I want mats for everything. Like, I just want mats so I can just fix whatever I need to in the comp, color grade it, fix a problem, move things, relight. Just give me mats and some really good world position passes and normal passes, and I'm a happy person. And like, if once I learned that, I was like, oh, okay, cool. So you start to flex and build up this muscle in your eyes to look at a render. The way that, think about it this way, if you're like a DP on set, and these are, you know, the days before you could really do color grading on set, you had to sort of like look through your frame and sort of imagine what it was going to look like when it came out the other end, all graded and pretty and all that sort of thing. You had to develop that muscle. You can't just, you know, show up on set and be able to expect it to look exactly like it's going to look when it goes out to final. And you have to do that in 3D. You have to be able to look at your frame buffer and say, okay, yep, okay, that's looking good. I'll push this contrast in the comp. I'll push this in the comp. I might tweak this backlight a little bit in the comp. I think I'm good. I'm gonna render this out. I'm done. And it, learn to build up that muscle so that you're not so dependent on 3D. And I think you'll be a better artist for it, and you'll be faster for it. And there'll be a lot of people that'll be like, well, I'm just gonna stay in 3D. It's real time now. I can do this in Octane or Redshift, whatever. And I can get that glow how I want it in 3D. I would say, yeah, you probably could. And to some people, that's a totally valuable, or, you know, if you're doing like Mike Beeple, for example, like, he just needs to get it out for the day. So he's going to try to stay in that app just to try to get it out, which makes total sense for somebody like that. But I would say that it's still a valuable skill to learn for anybody, because there's going to be a time when you want to change that glow after the fact, and you can't because you have to go all the way back into your 3D scene. So it's comping and all those kind of post skills are super valuable. Learning how to even key green screen. These are all skills that are really good to learn.
Green screen. Oh my gosh. I used to green screen all the time. I forgot.
Yeah.
I gotta do some green screen.
That used to be part of what we did. Like, that's,
yeah,
it was all just part of the gig, man. Like, got to key this out.
Well, that reminds me, like, there's so many of those, even like After Effects skills that maybe I should, well, let me pull this to the audience. Cause we're wrapping up here. I'm like literally shivering over here. Audience, do me a favor. I'm thinking about doing more After Effects tutorials. If you want to see those, I would love to get like some response in the comments, like, yeah, but also what I should do, because I forget I have all those years of After Effects, you know, compositing, all this stuff. A lot of what we talked about today in design and compositing, color correction and like all that stuff. I would love to do more of those. So if that sounds interesting to you guys, let me know down in the comments and let me know like where maybe I should start too. Second of all, what are some of the things that you've learned in the audience that has set you up for success that you didn't think you knew or that you didn't think you needed in your career that maybe came in handy over the years? I know we talked about even just the idea that I was like a wedding DJ and selling stuff at Best Buy, and like knowing how to talk to clients came from that side of my personality. So what are those things from you that were, that you're like, oh, I didn't know I needed that, that you might be able to type in the comments and help the next person learning all this stuff? And I guess we'll end with something I used to say in a lot of tutorials. I haven't said it in a long time, but I used to say, all right, and now we're just going to cheat this over here, and we're going to add this little glow over here, and we're going to fake this piece over here, and we're going to cheat it. And I used to say, and cheating's okay because this is motion design and not poker. And that is our job, right? Like, our job is to know these cheats and how to speed up things and where to pull from other parts of the world that isn't necessarily inside of the program. The more that you can learn that, curate those skills and build that into your education, no matter where you are in your career, I'll speak for myself. It's helped me immensely to learn those types of things. So if you're, you know, making it to the end of this, any of those topics are interesting to you with design and compositing and even just playing. I think Chris's points on video games and playing and seeing how other industries do things, that's been a huge part of my career as well. So, you know, I hope you got something out of this. Ramping up into our 100th episode. Stay tuned for that. And as always, thank you guys so much for your time. I'm going to go find a fire and maybe hot chocolate. And Chris, I hope you feel better, buddy.
Yep.
And Chad, I'll see you guys in another Grayscale Gorilla episode. What is this called? It's a podcast. I'll see you in another Grayscale Gorilla podcast really soon. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Woo-hoo.